Welcome to Base by Base. Imagine if we could dramatically improve cancer research, make breakthroughs faster, more equitable, and, you know, truly reflective of everyone affected by cancer. What if the key was simply rethinking how patients and communities are involved?
It's a powerful idea, absolutely. And it gets right at a historical challenge. For too long, genomic research has struggled with significant underrepresentation. It's just a fact. And this has led to crucial knowledge gaps for certain populations, which, you know, ultimately hinders our ability to develop truly effective prevention and intervention strategies for all. It's a fundamental issue of scientific fairness and really effectiveness, too.
That's such a crucial point. That historical context is, well, it's everything, isn't it? So building on that, how do we actually fix this? How do we move forward? That's what makes today's deep dive so exciting, I think. We're exploring a groundbreaking paper that lays out a tangible roadmap, you know, how to overcome these barriers, make research more relevant, and build genuine trust with the very people who stand to benefit most from advancements in cancer genomics. So we've established the why, this critical need for more equitable cancer research. But the big question is the how. How do you even begin to systematically tackle something so deeply ingrained, something with such a long history? And that's where this paper provides a framework, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, to help answer this, a team led by Dr. Krosner here and their colleagues published a landmark study. It was in Genetics and Medicine in 2025. It's really a foundational piece for this entire movement, kind of setting the stage.
And this paper, it stems from a massive initiative, doesn't it? The National Cancer Institute's, or NCI's, Ambitious Cancer Moonshot. That was launched back in 2016, I remember, with that really bold goal to end cancer as we know it.
Mm.
And a core part of this huge effort was establishing something called the Participant Engagement and Cancer Genome Sequencing Network, the PECGS network.
That's the one. PECGS. It was specifically designed to bridge those knowledge gaps we just talked about. And the way they aimed to do that was by intentionally engaging populations that have been, well, understudied historically. This meant actively confronting those traditional barriers to participation, things like, you know, the significant time demands on participants, or structural issues like research centers being hard to get to, or even, and this is huge, the deep-seated distrust that comes from historical injustices in medicine. So this paper, it really digs into how the PECGS network defines, measures, and crucially optimizes participant and community engagement in cancer genomics research.
Right, and the initial funding announcement for this network introduced these two core concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Participant engagement and engagement optimization. So participant engagement was basically an ongoing mutually beneficial interaction between study participants and researchers, like a two-way street. And engagement optimization was about using sort of rigorous behavioral research methods to find the best ways to actually achieve that engagement. But the real hurdle, I imagine, was getting this entire huge network, all these different centers, to agree on consistent definitions for these new concepts. How do you harmonize something like that?
That's exactly right. It was a major challenge. And that's precisely why one of the first critical steps was establishing the PECGS's Participant Engagement Subcommittee. And this wasn't just a small group meeting occasionally. It brought together a really diverse range of professionals, physicians, researchers, genetic counselors, all focused on generating tools and resources and really fostering this engagement across the network's five different research centers. They needed to be on the same page.
Okay, so this subcommittee gets formed. What were their first steps? How did they figure out what was already happening on the ground?
Well, their initial efforts began with a pretty strategic, two-pronged investigation. They wanted to understand how engagement was already being approached. So first, they did a comprehensive document review. And second, they conducted key informant interviews.
A document review sounds extensive. What kind of information were they digging through? What was the goal there?
Oh, it was extensive. They basically acted like detectives, you can say. Sifting through a massive amount of documentation from the network's first 3 years. So September 2020 to August 2023. This included everything from, you know, formal research protocols and specific aims documents to internal presentation slides, even public-facing materials like websites and social media posts. They were essentially mapping out everything the centers were doing related to engagement. How were they defining it? Who were they partnering with? What strategies were they actually trying out? And then to complement that, they conducted these key informant interviews, usually 2 to 5 representatives from each center, the people directly overseeing engagement and optimization efforts. These interviews were crucial. They helped clarify things found in the documents, added vital context, and gave some early insights into what impact these efforts might be having.
Wow, okay. So they gathered all this raw information, mountains of it probably, from documents and interviews. The next challenge must have been making sense of it all. How do they pull out the key themes and unique approaches from what sounds like an overwhelming amount of data?
Yeah, you're right. It would have been overwhelming. They used a method called qualitative content analysis. For listeners who might not be familiar, imagine having just a huge pile of notes, transcripts, documents. Qualitative content analysis is like a systematic way of organizing all that. You look for recurring patterns, for common themes, but also for the unique insights, the things that stand out. It helps you find the hidden threads, basically, and turn all that messy, complex information into something clear and actionable. It allowed them to really crystallize the concepts.
And that meticulous analysis, that crystallization, then led to the really crucial step. Reaching a consensus on those definitions of engagement and optimization, right?
Exactly. That was the goal. So they took the initial definitions that each center had sort of developed independently and collated them. Then new harmonized definitions were drafted. But it wasn't a one-shot deal. These drafts went through multiple rounds of iterative feedback, back and forth with the subcommittee, back and forth with the main steering committee, and the whole process culminated in a big network-wide meeting where all the members could discuss and further refine the definitions. The aim was to get genuine buy-in and ensure everyone had a shared understanding across the entire PECGS network. It sounds like it was a truly collaborative effort. So after all that work, what were the core revelations? What came out of this deep dive into engagement? Well, the network identified that engagement really encompasses two critical related aspects: participant engagement in research and community engagement in research, and this idea of engagement optimization that could be applied to both. And they landed on these clear, harmonized definitions. So engagement was defined as sustained and beneficial interaction between research teams and diverse individuals to inform research processes and improve outcomes. And optimization was defined as the use of scientific principles and methods to analyze and act upon insights from engagement, aiming to enhance research and engagement outcomes. Pretty clear, right?
Yeah, that sounds like a really powerful framework. Okay, so once they had these harmonized definitions, how do they actually picture engagement playing out in the real world of research? The paper introduces a conceptual model you mentioned. Can you walk us through that? How does it shift our understanding of where participant and community engagement actually fit in?
Yeah, this model is quite insightful, I think. It basically shows research being driven not just by scientific gaps, which is traditional, but also by genuine community priorities. That's a big shift. It clarifies that participant engagement activities, things involving the individuals in the study, primarily happen during the study conduct itself. But community engagement is broader. It's seen as a continuous process spanning the entire research journey from the initial planning stages right through the conduct and even into the dissemination of findings afterwards. And optimization, that's not locked into one phase. That can happen at any point along that whole continuum. The idea is to be constantly refining both participant and community engagement efforts.
Okay, that makes sense. It's a more holistic view. But how did they measure all this? You know, what did success actually look like in practice? How did they know if engagement was working?
That's a great question. When it came to measuring engagement, participant satisfaction was actually the only construct that all the centers assessed. Though, interestingly, they often used bespoke surveys, meaning each center kind of developed its own way of measuring satisfaction. So maybe not perfectly comparable across the board yet. But other common measures they looked at included things like participant knowledge about the study, levels of trust, the quality's communication, enrollment rates, obviously, and crucially, the reasons why individuals might decline to participate. Getting at that why not question gave them a much more nuanced picture beyond just the numbers.
Right. Understanding the barriers is key. So with these definitions, the model, and these measurement ideas, how did the actual engagement strategies play out in practice? Let's break it down by the different phases of research, maybe. Starting with outreach and recruitment, how do they get people involved? Sure. During the outreach and recruitment phase, it sounds like they used a mix of methods. All centers use, you know, the expected things, branded websites, social media, videos, even traditional brochures to get the word out. But what seems really key were the partnerships. Partnerships with patient groups, clinical groups, physician networks, leveraging existing relationships. And there's a good example here. The OptiMemories Center hosted these quarterly webinars in both English and Spanish, which is important. They covered relevant topics like disability services, and they actively promoted participation using testimonials from actual participants.
that feels like a really powerful way to build trust right from the start, hearing from peers.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, what about the consent phase? That's always such a critical, sometimes tricky part of research.
Absolutely critical. And here, it wasn't just about getting a signature on a form. Two centers specifically focused on enhancing comprehension. And the Juniper Center provided a really notable example. They incorporated American Indian visual artwork specifically, an eagle feather intertwined with the DNA stem right into the consent documents. The idea was to anchor the documents to the culture and improve understanding in a way that resonated locally. And importantly, this artwork wasn't just added casually. It was reviewed and approved by their tribal advisory committee,
wow,
making it truly culturally sensitive and meaningful.
That's incredible. It really shows how a seemingly small, culturally sensitive detail can make a massive difference in building trust and connection, doesn't it?
It really does. It shows they were listening.
Okay, so after consent comes data collection. What were the strategies there?
Here, the focus was really on accessibility and relevance for participants, making it easier and more meaningful for them. So the Count Me In Center, for instance, offered multiple ways for people to submit information using apps, which makes it convenient. And beyond just the clinical data, centers also gathered broader survey data, things like quality of life, participant preferences about the research, even levels of medical mistrust. And they used flexible methods to collect this, things like in-person surveys conducted in the participants' native language or digital surveys that allow participants to take breaks and come back later. It's all about making the process much more participant-centered, less burdensome.
That makes a lot of sense. And then a really important phase, the return of results. How did they handle giving information back to participants?
Yeah, this is increasingly recognized as vital. The focus here was on personal relevance, making sure participants could understand the information, delivering it how they preferred, and providing psychosocial support. So centers offered things like decision support tools to help people process the information. They provided reports in multiple formats, digital and paper copies, and they ensured crucial access to genetic counselors. The reports themselves were tailored, often aiming for around an eighth grade reading level to maximize clear comprehension. It's about truly empowering participants with their own data, not just dumping information on them.
Empowering, exactly. And finally, retention, keeping participants engaged long term.
Right. Maintaining that connection is key for longitudinal studies. Centers aim to do this through things like newsletters, regularly updated websites, virtual meetings, social media updates, even in-person events sometimes. The goal was to consistently share study updates, provide lay summaries of findings, just keep people in the loop. This isn't just about keeping the numbers up for the study. It's about maintaining a relationship built on that initial trust and demonstrating shared progress.
Okay, so that covers the strategies focused on individual participants. What about the broader community engagement side of things?
Yeah. Beyond the individuals, robust community engagement strategies were also paramount. Advisory boards were really a cornerstone here. These boards helped inform research priorities and guide activities. All the centers had multidisciplinary boards, bringing together diverse perspectives, patients, ethicists, lawyers, community leaders. But what's really compelling, I think, is that four of the five centers even supplemented these main boards with population-specific boards. So for example, Juniper's Tribal Advisory Committee, which included tribal governors and leaders, had real influence. They influenced everything from protocol review right down to establishing conditions for data sovereignty.
Wow.
This isn't just token consultation. It's more like shared governance. It's giving the community real power.
That's a significant difference. Shared governance.
Yeah.
What else on the community front?
Well, they also prioritized bi-directional communication, that two-way street again. This included things like listening sessions, discussions with patient groups, town hall meetings, roundtables, often held in person to really facilitate connection. The aim was both to gather community insights and to share research progress back out. And importantly, the PECGS annual network meetings were vital touch points. They brought together researchers, patient partners, community representatives, and they specifically used a hybrid format, both in person and virtual, to enhance accessibility and foster collaboration, making sure the conversation was what was happening within the academic bubble.
Okay, so we have all these engagement efforts targeting both participants and communities. Now let's talk about the optimization piece. Once these efforts were in motion, what did optimization actually look like? How did it tangibly impact the research itself?
Right. Optimization wasn't just a buzzword here. These efforts primarily aimed to develop and evaluate specific interventions. Interventions targeting recruitment, retention, data gathering, how results were communicated. And the optimization efforts were quite clever, actually. They integrated methods from different fields, behavioral science, clinical trials, even quality improvement approaches. This made them both robust, you know, scientifically sound, but also adaptable. The goal was continuous refinement based on evidence.
Can you give some concrete examples of how this optimization made a difference?
Sure. We saw some really clear examples of impact. For instance, the Count Me In Center revised the language they used for a return of somatic results.
Yeah.
Based on direct feedback from focus groups, they changed it to shared learnings about your tumor. It sounds subtle, but that change came directly from participants saying the original language wasn't clear or felt maybe a bit clinical.
That's a great example of listening.
Exactly. And Juniper, going back to them, established that whole framework for genomic research that explicitly respected tribal sovereignty and shared ownership. That wasn't just an engagement strategy. It was an outcome of optimizing their approach through community partnership, a monumental step, really. And another center, WUPECGS, worked closely with specific patient groups like Black or African-American adults with multiple myeloma and colorectal cancer. They addressed issues that came up in real time and refined their strategies based on that direct feedback loop. So this wasn't just abstract theory. It led to immediate practical adjustments in how the research was done.
It sounds very dynamic. What were some of the specific activities they used for optimization?
They were incredibly diverse, actually. Optimizing the recruitment process was something all centers focused on. They used methods like small randomized experiments or A/B testing on recruitment materials, and they conducted interviews specifically to understand why people might decline participation getting at those barriers again. Consent processes were also a target for improvement, using surveys and input from those advisory boards we mentioned. And it's particularly insightful, I think, that Juniper even sought to optimize the biospecimen collection protocols. They used racket cycle research to address cultural attitudes and concerns regarding genetic samples, specifically within American Indian communities.
Wow, that's drilling down deep.
It really is. It goes far beyond standard procedure.
Yeah.
The return of genomic results was another key area for optimization, with centers trying different assessment methods, different report formats, even using molecular tumor boards that included engagement experts. And retention approaches were also explored and optimized using interviews and testing different communication tools.
Okay, so zooming out now, thinking about the bigger picture of genomics research, what do all these results, these strategies, these definitions actually mean?
Well, looking at the broader implications, this work represents a truly significant effort. It's one of the first large-scale attempts to really define and systematically apply engagement and its optimization within cancer genomics research. It essentially lays a foundational framework. It gives us a starting point for developing evidence-based practices in this area, moving engagement beyond just good intentions or intuition towards something more data-driven.
And what seems really compelling, maybe even novel here, is the focus on engagement optimization itself. You mentioned it wasn't just about big formal studies. There were lots of these iterative, almost micro-optimizations happening alongside more traditional scientific methods like experimental studies. It really raises an important question for the field, doesn't it? How can we best balance the sort of rigor of controlled trials with the agility needed for rapid cycle research and continuous improvement in engagement? It feels like a new frontier in research methodology itself.
That's a fantastic point. And this overall approach, this focus on engagement, it seems to have had a demonstrable impact already, even in these early stages. It led to meaningful changes in study design, how research is actually conducted day to day. And what's perhaps even more remarkable is when you look at the demographics of the PECGS participants, the data shows a higher proportion of participants from racial and ethnic minority groups compared to previous major initiatives like the Cancer Genome Atlas Program, TCGA.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it really suggests significant progress is being made in addressing that historical underrepresentation we talked about at the start. It suggests these engagement strategies are actually working to diversify who participates in research.
And that really emphasizes the significance of PECGS's focus specifically on improving the research participant experience, which feels quite distinct from, say, general patient engagement in a hospital setting. It shows this isn't just about making patients feel good, although that's important. It's about scientifically optimizing their actual journey within a research study. It kind of elevates their role, doesn't it? From maybe passive subjects to more active collaborators. That feels like a massive shift in how we think about clinical trials and genomic studies. And I also found it fascinating how the network consciously chose the term community over a stakeholder. Hmm. You mentioned, because of negative connotations associated with colonialism, that the word stakeholder can sometimes carry.
Exactly.
That the choice speaks volumes about a deeper ethical awareness driving this work.
Absolutely. And that ethical awareness, combined with the practical approaches, aligns well with what we're seeing in other large genomics programs, too. There's a growing emphasis everywhere on using plain language, developing culturally tailored communications, providing personalized and timely return of results. This is all part of a concerted, field-wide effort, really, to overcome those historical barriers that have kept underserved populations from fully participating and benefiting from science. It's about working towards true equity.
So bringing it all together, what does this all mean for you listening, whether you're a researcher, a clinician, or just someone passionate about equitable science? Well, this deep dive establishes a really crucial foundation. It gives us a framework and early evidence for identifying data-informed practices that can genuinely strengthen participant and community involvement in cancer genomics research.
Though it is important to add a note of caution, perhaps, it's still early days in many ways. It's probably too soon to draw definitive conclusions about the overall impact on long-term research outcomes, like changes in cancer incidence or survival. And there's definitely a need for more work documenting the full range of these engagement optimization methods, the how-to. And further evaluation is still needed to confirm the long-term impact on participant diversity across different contexts. So this is very much an ongoing journey, not a final destination.
Right. Fair point. But this work absolutely opens up exciting future research directions and offers some key recommendations for action, things you can think about in your own work. First, the idea of establishing a robust infrastructure for engagement within research initiatives, going beyond just individual projects, really integrating community and participant representatives into all aspects of genomics research and clinical activities, maybe through formal consultants, or even funded community scientists. Second, developing a plan for measuring engagement and its impact right from the outset of any project. And critically, actively involving community members in creating those measurement plans. And finally, engaging community members in selecting harmonized constructs and measures. If we can collect similar engagement data across different studies and settings, it massively enhances the value and allows for better comparisons and learning.
Absolutely. And zooming out one last time, maybe connecting this back to the very beginning, this work raises a really important, maybe even provocative question for all of us to consider. How can these principles of engagement and optimization transform not just how we do cancer genomics research, but ultimately who benefits from it? How do we ensure these advancements lead to truly equitable progress for all communities?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you found this analysis valuable, the best way to support Base by Base is to hit follow on Spotify and leave a 5-star rating. It takes only a few seconds, but makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.